Case number 15-1023 et al. Henry Abe al-Brahim Hassan Muhammad al-Nasiri, a petitioner. Mr. Parody for the petitioner appellant. Mr. Palmer for respondent appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Before we start, I just want to remind counsel and alert everyone in the courtroom that the record in this case contains some very highly classified materials. They will not be discussed in this session. We will be going into a classified session after the public session to discuss those. And this portion of the argument will be limited to the legal issues that lie at the heart of this case, all of which, don't be disappointed, are quite interesting.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Perry, let's go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. This case asks the same question as Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, but here the answer is clearer than it was 10 years ago. The Department of Defense may not convene a military commission to try offenses that, by clearly established constitutional and statutory law, are not triable by military commission. We ask for the intervention of this court because for 400 years it has been the role of habeas corpus to prevent the executive from removing to its own special tribunals the trial of crimes that belong in the courts of law.
Well, so, something very important has happened since Hamdan, right? Congress has gotten involved, and Congress has created the military commissions, and Congress has made the judgment that they have created a tribunal that affords sufficient due process rights to enemy combatants, right? A considered, measured judgment by Congress. Why should we not defer to that judgment of Congress? That wasn't the case in Hamdan, right? Very different circumstance in Hamdan. Hamdan, the executive had created its own system that the Supreme Court decided was insufficient. What we have now is a new actor, a pretty important actor, in Congress. And now you're asking us that we should not defer to the considerative judgment of Congress. Why should we not?
Respectfully, Your Honor, we're not only asking you to defer to the considered judgment of Congress, we're asking you to enforce the judgment of Congress. Remember what Hamdan was about. Hamdan was about whether the executive branch, in convening the military commission to try Hamdan, had complied with the various aspects of the Uniform Code of Military Justice governing military commissions. It was a statutory case, like this one. Here, Congress passed 10 U.S.C., Section 950 PC, which says that an offense is only triable at all, if it occurred in the context of and was associated with hostilities. And so when it did that, it was not only setting a limit on what the executive could try, it was actually codifying 200 years of Supreme Court precedent that says the military
but
should
your answer isn't dealing with my councilman point, right? The councilman abstention point.
Sure,
Congress has created this system. Why should the federal courts not abstain, hold it in abeyance, as the district court did here, and let the military commission proceed as Congress intended it?
Well, I would disagree that Congress intended the court to abstain in this case, because when Congress puts a limit on the executive, there may be cases that were, let me just say as a threshold matter, that this court has never extended abstention to the military commissions in Guantanamo, and for good reason, and I'll get to those reasons. But I think
three of our district courts have, right?
Yes, but this court in Obidullah unanimously said that councilman really does not seem appropriate to the military commissions, and that's not only after.
In that case, there was no active military commission, right?
Well, I would say there was no active military commission here. We have not had proceedings in the military commission in over a year. We are not scheduled to have.
Here we have one that's convened and charged. You didn't have that in Obidullah, right?
That's correct. You had one. Well, with respect to councilmen, though, you did have one that was charged. You didn't have one that was convened. And in the ordinary councilman context, if this was an ordinary military justice case, that would be enough. As long as there's some proceeding underway in the military, there's an exhaustion requirement. So in Obidullah, under pure councilman analysis, should come out the other way. But even assuming there is an abstention doctrine that should be fashioned for military commissions generally, I think in this case, there are a number of reasons. One is irreparable harm, which we'll talk about in the closed session. But I think the most important question here is the statutory question. There are, by our count, two, maybe three statutory limits on what is tribal in a military commission. Those are the citizenship of the defendant.
But wasn't that true in the court-martial system that's at issue in Councilman?
No, there was no statutory limit on what was tribal. Here we're actually asking this court to simply, this is, to put it bluntly, a Category 3 Youngstown case. You have a federal statute telling the executive it may only do something when. That thing has not happened, and the executive has gone ahead and done it anyway. And so if there was ever a case...
Just pause briefly and tell us that thing is not happened. What is that thing that is not happened?
That thing is the existence of hostilities at any time relevant to the charges in this case.
Isn't that the issue, whether that was the case or not?
Well, that's certainly
our claim. I won't accuse you of reasoning in a circle, but you seem to be starting with your conclusion.
Well, I don't think we are. I think if anyone comes to this court with a substantial claim, that's this court's language
you've got two... I don't mean to interrupt Judge Santel's question, your answer, but we have two different proceedings before us. Mm-hmm. We have your mandamus action, and we have the appeal from the denial of preliminary injunction in the habeas case.
That's correct.
Right? Okay. Are you talking about that? What are you talking about now? Which one?
Well, I think...
Because Councilman has nothing to do with the mandamus action.
That's
right?
Absolutely correct. Okay. Councilman has nothing to do with that.
But to succeed in that case... You have to have an indisputable right to relief.
Yes, and we have that here. We certainly think we said it. And I hope this answers Judge Santel's question.
Well, why don't we talk about this for a minute and then come back just to sort these out, because the legal standards are quite different, okay? But so you think the right is indisputable here?
That's correct.
That is that this is that the I need to be careful here. That the events that led to the charges against this detainee occurred in a time and place where there were no hostilities, correct?
Yes, the president said as much.
Yeah, but so are there any cases that, I see your evidence, you've got a lot of evidence about what the president and the secretary and other people have said, but for it to be indisputable, you need to cite some cases, I think, that say that's the kind of evidence we look to, and under the circumstances of this case, that evidence is conclusive. Mm-hmm. And I think one of your biggest problems is that I think in Hamdan, the justices and the court couldn't agree on when it started.
Right? Well, in Hamdan...
That was part of the dispute in Hamdan.
That was certainly part of the dispute.
So if they couldn't agree, how can we say it's indisputable?
It's indisputable, I would say, for two reasons. Yeah. One, under this court's precedence, I would point this court specifically to Hamdan versus United States, where Judge Kavanaugh began his analysis of the question by saying, on September 11th, America went to war. That war continues. And so,
that's not a finding of fact that there were no hostilities before that.
Well, it is, Your Honor, and here's why.
It sounds like it says that's when it began.
Exactly, and insofar as the charges here are all alleged to have occurred a year before September 11th.
The beginning of what is described as the war in Judge Kavanaugh's quotation does not foreclose the possibility that there were hostilities preceding that.
Well, Judge Kavanaugh's opinion may not foreclose that possibility.
No, it doesn't.
That's
just not logically compelled by that sentence.
Well, but I would say the uniform acts of the political branches, both before, during, and after 9/11.
What do you do with the fact that in Hamdan, as Judge Tatel referred to, three of the justices thought they began in 1996? It was a debated issue. It's a tough call. When hostilities began. Undercuts your argument that it's indisputably clear that they didn't precede 9/11.
Well, again, remember what was at issue in Hamdan. Hamdan was a conspiracy case, and the question before the court was whether or not these acts and allegations that predated 9/11 were essentially part of the hostilities that could be tried when you also had post 9/11, 9/11-related conduct. That's ultimately what
So do you disagree with my characterization that three of the justices of the United States Supreme Court in Hamdan thought that the hostilities to which you're referring began as early as 1996. Am I reading it wrong?
I don't think...
That's possible.
I would say that's a possible reading of it, but I think it has to be read in the context of the issue before the court, and also before that Congress acted. And I think this does come back to Congress, because when Congress... Remember, Section 950PC, the hostilities, whether or not hostilities existed, makes something tribal or not. That was not even part of the 2006 Act. It certainly wasn't part of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It was added in the 2009 Act as part of a broader legislative effort to effectively codify at least a large amount of Justice Stevens' opinion from Hamdan. And if you look to the Congressional Research Service summary of the amendments that we provided this court, they specifically refer to Hamdan as establishing what Section 950PC was intended to do. Not just Hamdan v. Rumsfeld, but also what the military commission in the Hamdan case, post-Hamdan v. Rumsfeld, did.
Mr. Barrett, unless my colleagues have any other questions about the mandamus petition, let's go on to the habeas issue. And the is that okay with you?
That's fine.
Okay. Fine. And let me and bring us back to this. The government's argument, of course, is that the district court should have abstained under counsel. And before we get into that, I just have a couple of sort of status questions about this case.
Yes, sir.
What's the exact status of the commission proceedings involving this detainee right now?
The military commission proceedings were stayed in large part in September of 2015.
And did your client move for that stay?
No, the stay was the result of the fact that the government took an interlocutory appeal to the CMCR, and that had the effect of essentially staying a substantial part of the case.
Why? Couldn't it go forward with respect to the other two incidents?
Then the government appealed another aspect of the case on an interlocutory basis, which had the effect of staying the entire case, I want to say, in March of 2015.
I'm confused. So is it officially stayed now? That is,
yes.
The military commission. It is stayed?
Yes, the military commission has stayed. And
could the commission on its own decide tomorrow to proceed with the two charges that are still pending? Could it do that?
No, because one of the grounds the government has subsequently appealed on, which ultimately caused the stay of the whole proceeding, dealt with the capital sentencing factors, which affected it.
Okay. All right. So now let's go back to the questions Judge Griffith started on and the government's argument about councilmen. Argument is that a councilman requires abstention here, and the difference now is that, unlike at the time of Hamdan, when the court did not abstain, we now have a congressionally enacted system to which the government argues the federal courts should abstain. That's their argument.
Yes, I understand their argument. And I would say a federally enacted system certainly is a necessary condition for abstention. And we're not disputing that. We're simply saying that when the very limits Congress has imposed as part of that system, as they had in Hamdan. That, again, remember, Hamdan is about whether or not the executive was complying with, as I think Justice Kennedy said, the statutory limits on the power of the executive to convene military commissions. And so when you're dealing with that narrow question, and again, I think there are only three in the Military Commissions Act that we've been able to find. It's the hostilities question, citizenship, and double jeopardy. And those are the only three rights not to be tried, so to speak, that exist in the Military Commissions Act. And so I think when you're dealing with those, abstention, no abstention, military commission, no abstention, those are threshold questions that, to use this court's language from the earlier iteration of the Hamdan case, that raise a substantial challenge to the military's right to try them at all. So even if, again, an abstention doctrine were appropriate, when you're attempting to enforce limits Congress has imposed as they were in Hamdan, that's just not where councilman has to back off there, because otherwise you have the executive branch essentially running roughshod not only over the courts but over Congress and over the limits Congress has put onto the executive.
Your argument is that these offenses are not triable, correct?
Yes, that's what the statute says.
Yeah. Suppose, just this hypothetical, suppose the government's right that these are really not questions of whether a detainee is triable, but they're elements of the offense that have to be proven during the hearing. Suppose that's right. Okay, they're just elements of the offense. What are the other basis for your claim that the detainee has for claiming a right not to be tried?
Twofold.
Constitutional?
Yes, it is a constitutional right. This is actually the identical claim that was raised in Reed versus Covert. Uh-huh. And in Reed versus Covert, I would say the statute went the other way. Uh-huh. Congress had authorized the trial of dependents accompanying the armed forces overseas. There was even a treaty authorizing that. And the Supreme Court intervened pre-trial on the grounds that the executive may not circumvent the courts of law to try offenses by military tribunal when they did not occur in the context of hostilities. And just to finish that thought, and that was to distinguish Mattson versus Kinsella, which the court had only decided 2 or 3 years earlier, where they had held that the military may try civilians for offenses occurring in the context.
Reed versus Covert decided on constitutional ground or on the extent of the statute?
It struck a statute down, Your Honor. It was decided on Article
constitutional ground, right?
Yes, that's right. It was Article 3, 5th, and 6th. And Justice Harlan, I would say, concurred separately on Eighth Amendment grounds because he said in the context of capital cases, these safeguards absolutely come to the fore. And the Supreme Court reaffirmed that in, I think, 1960 in Grisham v. Hagen. And so I think...
Did you have another question about counsel?
No.
I just have two quick questions about irreparable injury. It has nothing to do with the facts.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. One of the claims is that being tried before a military commission puts the detainee at a disadvantage because he's also facing trial in the Southern District, right?
That's correct.
But hasn't Congress banned transferring any detainees to United States courts?
Yes, they've done so in the National Defense Appropriate.
Right.
Authorization Act. That's up for review every year. It's an annual political fight. Yeah. The president vetoed it last year, only to sign it later. So I think that certainly is, to the extent that's a restriction at all, I don't think al-Nashiri can hang his hat on it.
And finally, on irreparable injury, assume that we thought councilman abstention was not appropriate. That you're right. Is it your view that we should go on and address the other elements of preliminary injunction or send it back to the district court?
Given the posture of this case, particularly the fact that it's been consolidated with the mandamus case, I think this court is in as good a position to provide clarity on this issue as the district court would be, say, 6 months from now if it was remanded. But if this court does find councilman's inappropriate, then yes, the case could be remanded to the district court for further proceedings in a habeas case, like in Reed versus Covert, for that matter.
Okay. Anything else? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. I'm Joseph Palmer from the Justice Department.
Let me just, before you get into it, I just have a couple of fact questions for you. The detainee says that the trial in this case before the commission at the earliest won't be until 2018. Do you disagree with that? You think that's right?
I don't think we disagree necessarily. Yeah. There isn't a set trial date
right.
at this point, and the petitioner's counsel is correct that the proceedings are in general stayed for purposes of the interlocutory review, although I'm not sure the extent to which that stay has actually delayed the proceedings further because of the discovery, the broad discovery that the military commission has ordered remains ongoing, and the government is continuing to comply with that order.
Do you agree with Mr. Paradis that until the CMCR issue is resolved, this can't go forward, right? The military commission could not decide to proceed on the two other charges. Is that right?
Yes, I think that's correct, Your Honor, at this point.
And one other question. If someone is convicted by a military commission and they first go to the convening authority, right? Is that where the appeal goes first?
That's correct.
And am I reading this correctly that there's no deadline on when the convening authority acts? Do you know of any?
I'm not aware of a deadline for the convening authority's action.
All right. Okay, great. And one last question. Could the petitioner here, could he have filed a mandamus action with the CMCR, assuming it was properly constituted?
I'm not sure that that's precisely clear, Your Honor. The rules for the was Your Honor's question about the Court of Military Commission Review?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The rules for that court, as petitioner points out, indicate that such a petition would not be well taken.
Right.
And there's been,
okay.
But the question of whether those rules are inconsistent with the statute in light of this court's decision in this case last year that this court had mandamus jurisdiction is perhaps unclear.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
If I could just briefly address
the clearing. Take that time out of my allocation, not yours.
If I might just quickly address the clear and undisputed point that Judge Griffith was discussing, which is to say that of course, this court made clear in last year's mandamus petition that open questions of law are not suitable for mandamus. And as of the time of Hamdan, of course, this was an open question. It has only become more open, so to speak, since Congress has acted by specifically providing in the Military Commissions Act that military jurisdiction can be found for offenses that are occurring before, on, or after September 11th.
Doesn't Hamdan suggest, I think it's note 20 in Hamdan suggests, that there is an area that we will not allow military commissions to consider, right? There's this personal jurisdiction area, they call it. When there's a claim, and I think the footnote says that when there's a claim that the military authority is acting ultra vires, right? That in those cases, we're not going to abstain. We're going to let the federal courts get involved. Why isn't that this case? Isn't that the heart of their argument that the military commission has an authority to try this sort of issue?
Your Honor, I think this the petitioner's claim here is not of that type, but is instead closely analogous to the claim that was at issue in Councilman itself. The defendant in Councilman contended that his offenses were not triable by a military court because they were not service-connected, and the Supreme Court had held that service connection requirement was necessary for the offense to be triable.
So
is
that
court.
Footnote in Hamdan wrong?
That footnote refers to claims of personal jurisdiction, and for purposes...
But they described it in terms of ultra-virus jurisdiction. That's what we have here, isn't it?
I think this claim is for the jurisdictional...
You're right, they used the phrase personal jurisdiction, but in explaining it, it was more expansive than what we traditionally think of as personal jurisdiction, at least as I read it.
The way we understand that councilman exception and that limitation is when petitioners raise a claim of that by their status they are not subject to military jurisdiction at all, analogous to the civilians, the undisputed civilians who raise claims in the Reed and the Toth line of cases. In those cases, then, there may be an exception to councilman. But when the claim is one of the type of offense is not...
The timing of offense in this case. In the original Hamdan, it was type of offense. Here it's the timing is the question, is it, or do I misunderstand?
No, I think that's correct, Your Honor. That it has to, but it has to do with whether this conduct is triable in a military commission, and the issue is one that involves facts and that involves the application.
It's going to be a tough issue, right? The very point you make that it's not indisputably clear shows this is a really difficult legal issue. When do hostilities begin? Why wouldn't a federal district court be better situated than a military commission to take that issue up? There's no particular expertise that the military commission has in determining when hostilities begin under the Constitution, is it?
Well, with respect to that, I think there is. The military's expertise is relevant to that question, although I would say the first answer to the question is that Congress clearly intended in the Military Commissions Act that these claims be decided in the first instance in the military commission, and that this court's review of that question would benefit from the application of military expertise to the question of whether the hostilities question turns in part on the military nature of the violent acts between the parties to the conflict. And it also turns on the military nature of the particular conduct that the defendant is accused of committing. And so the military commission...
all that evidence would be before the district court. The district court would have all that.
Well, at this point, I don't think the evidence is before the district court.
But that's because the district court abstained. But if the district court's not supposed to, all of that evidence that you just described would be before the district court, and the district court would make a decision about whether this was, quote, hostilities within the meaning of the statute. I'm just pursuing Judge Griffith's question. Where's the expertise to which we would defer? It sounds like all there is a lot of facts which can be presented either to the commission or a district court. But there's really no military expertise on this question. In fact, to me, you can make a pretty good argument that that under the Constitution, ultimate decisions about when hostilities exist are not military decisions.
Well, first, if I could take that up in parts, there's no question that the ultimate decision belongs to this court. We're not disputing that the military commission judgment cannot become final until this court has reviewed the hostilities question. But if the district court were to take it up without the expertise of the military commission members and of the Court of Military Commission Review, which Congress set up to become experts not only in facts but in issues related to the law of war. But again, I think the military commission members are well situated as military experts to recognize the essentially military character of the terrorist attacks that are alleged in the case.
Don't you think it's extraordinarily counterintuitive to think that a judgment about when hostilities exist is a judgment on which the military, that courts owe deference to the military on that question? That just doesn't seem right to me under our Constitution. That seems like a fundamentally presidential and congressional question, not a military question. And for purposes of our discussion here, let's just assume this. I hear your point that the D.C. Circuit can ultimately address this question after, if there's a conviction. But assume for purposes of our discussion today that the detainee has a good case for irreparable injury. Right? Let's just assume that for purposes of argument.
Okay.
So then under those circumstances, saying that, well, we can get to this after he's convicted doesn't really respond to the question because he has a pending motion for preliminary injunction, right, to avoid irreparable injury. So then we do have to squarely face the question about, as you raised it, about counsel. And Judge Griffith's question really is, what's the reason to wait? What would the courts gain from that, given his meritorious claim for irreparable injury?
Well,
that's the question.
I think the first answer and a crucial answer is that Congress has made clear its intent that these questions be decided in the first instance in the military commission.
How has it made that clear?
I think it has made that clear, Your Honor.
I just said how. I wasn't.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm just asking you how.
Primarily in creating the integrated system of military review and appellate procedures before the convening authority and the CMCR, and also in providing for this court's review in Section 950G of the Military Commissions Act, there's an exhaustion requirement, and there's also a statement that this court...
But that doesn't answer... To me, the question is, has Congress given to the military commission the authority to decide the issue before us now, that the petitioner wants to be before us now, and that is whether there were hostilities involved, right? What is your authority for your argument, I take it to be, that Congress has given to the military commission the authority to make that decision and not to allow the federal district court to do so while it's considering it?
Well,
issue about whether hostilities exist.
The Military Commissions Act states that the military commission is a competent tribunal for jurisdiction. The Military Commissions Act...
For jurisdiction of what?
For jurisdiction for purposes of a military commission trial, for satisfying the jurisdictional...
For war crimes, right? War crimes.
Yes.
And the question here is, are we in a circumstance where a war crime is capable of being committed? Now, has Congress given the military commission the authority to decide that? And if so, where?
Again, in creating the statutory requirement in Section 950 PC that states that a nexus to hostilities must be proved for all of the offenses, and in making that an element of the offenses, the implication there is that Congress intended for that issue to be resolved in the first instance by the military commission, then through the military system of appeals, and then ultimately decided by this court. And Councilman says that that kind of claim should be deferred to by the federal courts.
So I hear you saying because it's an element of the offense, and therefore the military commission has authority to take it up. Is that right?
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay.
What's the closest case to this one where councilman has been applied? That is to say, if you would, is there a case where the courts have applied councilman abstention when the issue involved the jurisdiction over a non-member of the U.S. military, for example?
Well, I'm not aware of any cases other than the district court cases here and in this case in Washington where councilman has been applied in the military commission context. But I think that councilman, the claim there is closely analogous to the claim here, and there is the reasons that this court or that the Supreme Court gave in councilman for deferring to this system that Congress created with a right of direct appeal to courts independent of the military. That rationale applies with full force to the military.
Let's pursue that a little bit. I'd like to. I think that's the heart of the question that you're now raising. But first of all, you're not arguing, are you, that councilman requires the courts to abstain, are you? Right?
No,
you're not making that argument. Okay.
We're not making that argument.
So what we have to do is what you just started to do, which is to look at the situation, at the court-martial's situation, councilman, and look at the one we have here, right, and see whether the same factors call for abstention here as they did there, right? So let me just tell you, suggest to you that what I see the differences as being, and you tell me what your reaction is, okay? So the petitioner here is not a member of the armed forces like he was in councilman, right? So there's no unique interest in military discipline at work. That's number one. Number two, the military commissions are not a self-contained judicial system, right, in which Congress excluded the federal courts. In fact, the system includes the federal courts, us, right, the D.C. Circuit. Third, there's four of these, by the way. Third, the system here isn't applying a unique body of law, like court-martial law, right? Quote, without counterpart in civilian life. That's a quote from councilman. You know, quite to the contrary, federal courts exercise jurisdiction over similar or identical criminal behavior. And finally, the court-martial system, unlike the court-martial system, this system isn't permanent. It's convened when needed, and it ends when the war ends. So when I look at all of those, I say to myself, none of the factors that drove abstention there, even though now we do have Congress acting, which I totally agree with you, puts a thumb on the scale of abstention, even given that, these fundamental differences, it just does not look like a system where, you know, Congress intentionally excluded the federal courts, created a separate independent system for review. It just doesn't feel like abstention. So what's the answer to all that?
Your Honor, I may need you to remind me of some of your list, but taking up the first...
Should we go back through it one by one? I'm happy to do it.
Taking up the first one of the military's interest, it's true that there isn't the precise interest in discipline of service members,
right,
but there is a military interest of equal or greater weight at issue in this case, in the interest in deterring and in punishing violations of the law of war is an important incident of war, as the Supreme Court has recognized, and I think that the interest of in this case and the magnitude of the offenses that are alleged is at least as strong as the interest in the marijuana offense that was at issue in Councilman.
I hear you. You made that point in your brief, and I think that's a good point. But the fact is there's a huge overlap, right, between the conduct that violates the laws of war and conduct that violate U.S. criminal code. And we have dozens and dozens of terrorism cases pending in the federal courts. So it's not like a separate system. And these cases are tried in the federal courts and before military commissions. Whereas in Councilman, there was a distinct, powerful interest to get these court-martial cases decided in a separate system, you know, where Congress had carefully balanced all these rights. And there was no counterpart in the federal courts. Nothing.
I'm not sure it's true that the offense in Councilman would not have been triable in federal courts. He was the offense was trafficking in marijuana off of the military post. Mm-hmm. But putting that aside, okay. the separateness of the systems doesn't eliminate the risk of interference and of confusion that would occur if we had multiple district courts considering multiple habeas petitions out of multiple military commission trials, and the complete separateness of the court-martial system from the federal courts.
Well, that's not exact. I mean, I guess that might be right if that was the world, but we've got one case, and in a case where you agree might not even be tried for 2 or 3 years. Where's the risk of interference with anything here? And, the military commission is stayed. There's no risk at all of interference in the commission's action. Is there, in fact, right?
Well, there are other cases pending, and multiple at this point habeas petitions pending in district court, and so we think there's still a substantial risk of conflicting judgments when issues are before the military commission at the same time as they are before a federal district court.
Mm-hmm. So what's the best argument? What is the best argument for applying Councilman here? Which of all these factors that they talked about at Councilman, which is or is it a combination of factors?
I think it's a combination, but the most important principle is a deference to Congress and to its decision to create a system of military review and appellate procedures that has final judgment review by an independent court, and where the application, this court's ultimate review, would be benefited by development of the record and application of the military commission and military appellate court's expertise.
What is your position as to what happens if we decide Councilman does not apply? What should we do then?
Well, I think the court should... In addition to Councilman, we think that Section 950G itself indicates that the interlocutory challenges to military commission rulings should be heard in this court by mandamus, that the 950G gives exclusive jurisdiction to this court, and that habeas jurisdiction should only come after this court has acted.
What should our order say at the end of the opinion if we decide Councilman does not apply? But we have this here on the two cases intertwined. You're arguing both of them. What is our order going to be at the end of this if we decide Councilman doesn't apply?
It should say that Section 950G precludes a challenge to a military commission ruling by habeas, and instead that interlocutory challenge should be decided by this court on mandamus, and then the court should deny the mandamus petition because the claims aren't clear and indisputable.
Well, suppose we don't agree with that. Just to follow up Judge Santel's question, suppose we think, number one, there shouldn't be abstention, and number two, there is habeas jurisdiction. Then what?
Well, ultimately, we think that the issue is one that requires, if the court's determination is that the habeas court should reach the merits of the hostilities question, then we think it should go back rather than that this court should.
Including on irreparable injury? That should go back too.
Yes, if the court determines that that requirement has been satisfied.
Let me ask you just one other question.
I'm sorry. I didn't get the answer to that. The question, is, as I understood the question, was if we disagreed with you on councilman, right, and then we have in front of us the preliminary injunction, we're then ruling on the preliminary injunction, and an alternate ground for the denial of the preliminary injunction was that there was no irreparable harm. And what is your – I thought that was the question Judge Taylor was asking. What do we do about that?
We
send that back as well?
No, we've argued that this court could affirm on that alternative ground and find
– You're not giving that up then by your answers to Judge Taylor and by
– No, I didn't mean to – I think I misunderstood Judge Taylor's
question. No, I understood your point. Your point is that if we can look at this ourselves and if we think there's no irreparable injury, that's another basis for it, right?
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
This is appealable. Right. If the process goes ahead with the trial, et cetera, it winds up with an appeal to federal court anyway in the end. So you would say that there is an adequate remedy and there's not irremediable harm.
That's correct, Your Honor, just as the court found with the petitioner's mandamus petition last year.
Yeah, I just have one more question. Your emphasis in your briefing here is that the difference between this and Hamdan now is we have Congress creating this system, right?
Yes.
We have to defer to it. Suppose Congress, after congressional hearings, creates a special court system for domestic terrorism to try cases of domestic terrorism, and it authorizes the Secretary of Defense to create special panels to try people accused of domestic terrorism in the United States, and that's then appealable to the D.C. Circuit. And the first person arrested under this system files a habeas petition, and would the government, would you say councilmen would keep the courts out of that?
I think probably not, Your Honor, because that claim would be analogous to the Reed versus Covert type claim. It would be that civilian would have a constitutional claim without any disputed facts, without any need for application of military expertise, but that by virtue of his status as a U.S. civilian, he wasn't subject to the jurisdiction of that court. And that claim wouldn't have the same rationale as the court relied on in councilman, saying this is the kind of question on which our view would benefit from the military taking the first.
And suppose we didn't agree with you that there's any military expertise at issue here, then aren't the cases identical?
Well, there's still the distinction between a personal jurisdiction, a question of status. And for purposes of this appeal, the petitioner hasn't challenged his status as an alien, unprivileged, enemy, belligerent. Instead, his claim is focused on whether his offenses were committed in the context of hostilities, which is closely analogous to the claim that was at issue in councilman.
All right.
Let me ask you a question. The stay of the district court proceedings, did it stop all of the habeas claims? Because there were habeas claims filed in 2008 that were about, I believe, were about condition of confinement and status as an enemy combatant. What is the status of those claims?
As I understand it, that petition has been replaced. That is, petitioner asked to supplement that petition with the petition raising the hostilities claim, and that petition has now gone away and been replaced by a petition seeking to enjoin the military commission on the grounds that are before the court.
So the entire habeas case in the district court has stayed. All elements of it have been stayed.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Perez, you used up all your time. We'll give you 3 minutes.
I'd mainly like to just address factual points that my friend raised, and then we can, and not obviously take any of your questions. What I would start with is I would add a fifth factor to your factors, Judge Tatel, and I think it's the most important one, and it's the lack of any kind of speedy trial mechanism. Courts martial are notoriously quick, and there is confidence that the courts can have that the review procedures, the trial itself, will happen promptly so that we're not in the situation where, as here, and we've sort of calendared this out, that the earliest this case will get to this court is probably 2024. And that's a very long time for this important of an issue to remain hanging over this case. And I think it's also a very long time for an important issue such It's a very long time for the very question of whether or not he is triable. And that's the language Congress used, triable. They didn't say it's an element of all the offenses. They said the convening authority may not convene a military commission unless the offenses are triable, and these offenses are not triable.
But your argument doesn't turn on the on you winning that argument, right? The statutory argument.
I'm sorry, maybe I misunderstood.
Your case doesn't turn on you prevailing on the statutory issue there, right?
Right. We have both statutory and constitutional grounds, and I would just pick up on the point about Reed versus Covert. There was no question about the civilian status in Reed versus Covert. The question was whether or not civilians accompanying the armed forces to Germany, or excuse me, to Japan and the United Kingdom, which were not theaters of hostilities at the time the offenses were committed, could be tried in the same way that someone who had been tried in Germany, an identical person could be tried in Germany for the identical offense where hostilities were, in fact, ongoing. So okay. that is this case. With respect to Congress's intent to exclude this court's jurisdiction or habeas jurisdiction, if this was 2006, I would probably have to begrudgingly agree with my friend, because as part of the 2006 Act, Congress enacted Section 950JB, which said that any challenge to a military commission whatsoever, habeas corpus, you name it, is barred. And in 2009, Congress repealed that without changing any other part of the Military Commissions Act, not the least Section 950G, which is just this court's appellate jurisdiction. So if Congress had an intent to exclude the courts, particularly on a question that is so traditionally heard in habeas corpus pretrial, then we would at least expect Congress to say so, instead of saying the offenses are not triable unless they occurred in the context of hostilities. I would point out that there are not only dozens of terrorism cases, there's an indictment in this case, and that does put this case in a very unusual situation, where if al-Nashiri is tried and prevails on this precise argument in 2024, he can still be taken to the Southern District of New York on the indictment that's been pending since 2003. And that
would
does
not at least be a double jeopardy argument to be made there, or?
No, because if this goes to whether or not the military commission is acting ultra vires, and if it's acting ultra vires, there was no jurisdiction to begin with, and he's subject to retrial. So we are facing two bites at this apple. The government says this is an open question. This is a hard question. I understand that there are aspects of this question that may be difficult, but when the president of the United States says America is not at war, when Congress defines the very term veteran. As
it says, America is not at war?
Yes, President Clinton, in direct response to the bombing of the USS Cole, said that even when America is not at war, we must remember the world is a dangerous place. That even
at
a time,
he said America is not at war. He said even when America is not at war, we must remember.
Well, but referring, and then he said even when America, even in times of peace, peace is not free because we have our men and women who serve around this country bravely, even in times of peace, and face risks, and they do. And
the question here is hostilities.
That's correct, Your
Honor. Hostilities is not precisely the same as war.
For the purposes of the Military Commissions Act, it is.
Right, you cite in your reply brief Bassey v. Tingey from the John Adams administration era, where the issue there was what's an enemy. There was no declaration of war. There was nothing in congressional enactments that said we are at war. And yet Justice Washington's opinion distinguishes between the general war that has to have the declaration of war and a state of war, the state of being an enemy, and finds that France was in fact an enemy based on the fact that we're shooting at each other.
Well, look to the public acts of the political branches, and I would say that an even harder case was probably posed by the American Civil War, where you had numerous acts of what we would call hostility.
That's insurrection.
Leading up.
That would not necessarily be applicable to war.
That's not correct, Your Honor. That was a non-international armed conflict.
That's what I'm saying. That was a non-international armed conflict of insurrection.
Absolutely, but even
so
there,
it could be insurrection and not be war, or vice versa, would not be controlling any event.
Well, when the Supreme Court analyzed this question, I would say the most concise Supreme Court opinion I've ever read, actually, is the Protector.
Yeah.
They said, when it comes to whether or not something is hostilities, we look to the public acts of the political branches to draw that line. And I would just say, For good reason, because
Justice Washington said we look to see whether they're shooting at each other.
That's right, because Americans were shooting at each other plenty prior to that.
That was in the course of war with France, the time of Ubass v. Tingey, which you cite.
Well, yes, but remember, they also looked at the public acts of the president enacting blockades. These are warlike public acts, and that's what we say. That's all we're saying the court needs to look to here, and certainly since the War Powers Resolution, hostilities has been a pretty bureaucratic process. The president submits a declaration or a notice to Congress saying hostilities exist here, and
has the constitutionality of that act ever been passed on?
No, but the president
has. How many presidents have admitted it was constitutional?
The reporting requirements the president have never objected to, actually.
Well, actually, they've always said, though, we're not conceding the constitutionality of this act when we make the report, and that, even Jerry Ford did.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct.
In light of Ford's.
That's absolutely correct. But this is a bright line, and if I could just say why it's important to have a bright line, is because when you have particularly non-state actors like insurrectionaries or like those people in Oregon declaring war on the United States, we look to the political branches to determine whether or not what they're doing has any status under the law of war. Because remember, the law of war swings both ways. We can, you know, we can detain them, we can try them by military commissions, perhaps we can even target them with drones. But they can shoot back, and it's perfectly legal for them to shoot back so long as they comply with the bare minimum standards the law of war sets out. And that's such a radical thing in our country, and it's entrusted so carefully to the political branches at the highest possible level, and they've come back and given you no authority to say that any hostilities existed, certainly as they relate to the Cold War prior to 9/11.
Thank you. We will take a brief recess while the courtroom is secured. Thank you.
Thank you.